Case of Manna Bay versus the Commonwealth.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Charles Weber. I represent Manna Bay in this matter. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
3 minutes, yes, sir.
There's a number of issues here, but I'm going to merge issues one and two because they both involve the what we call the incidental detention doctrine. And in our view, that this case is sort of Exhibit A for the enduring wisdom of what Justice Kelsey said in a case about this, that said that Hoyt produced an anomaly difficult to describe and harder to administer. So this case is about Hoyt and the footnote 4 in Hoyt that says this is a matter of law.
And I understand that. I understand why you quote Justice Kelsey's, then Judge Kelsey's concurrence. But the last line of that concurrence notes, but Hoyt is a published decision, essentially, Hoyt is a published decision of this court that's binding on this panel.
That's true.
He said the reason he was concurring and not dissenting.
He did say that, and that was based upon the way the court had ruled in Wiggins. And I'm going to argue that what he didn't say was that it's not a jury issue. I think he argued that it should be a jury issue, and he argued eloquently that it should.
But you understand we're in the same position, even if we were to agree with you that the footnote 4 in Hoyt is wrong. As a panel of three, we can't do anything about it.
Your Honor, I would argue that the footnote 4 is not necessarily a holding, and the court can revisit some issues with that.
But both Wiggins and Smith have recognized it as a holding. Subsequent cases have recognized it as a holding. They're all published. We're bound by them. And then Judge Kelsey and his concurrence recognized it was a holding because he said he disagreed with it. He thought it was wrong, but he was bound by it.
Fair enough, Your Honor. And I'm still going to argue that Hoyt ought to be overruled here for a variety of reasons, that it still ought to be a jury issue, even if Hoyt is upheld.
I guess what I'm trying to tell you is you have checked the box that you need to check going forward on Hoyt not being good law.
Yes, Your Honor. The first question, of course, is it a jury issue? I mean, even independent of whether it's just a matter of law, is it a jury issue? And in that case, Hoyt says there are certain factors that have to be considered. And I guess the first question is, are factors somehow different from facts? Because the Apprendi line of cases says any facts that have to be found have to be submitted to a jury. So is there any real distinction between a set of facts and factors as described
in
Hoyt?
But Wiggins and Smith all come after Apprendi, do they not?
Understand. But Wiggins also says that a jury is entitled to draw legal conclusions. And that's in the Wiggins case. They're entitled to do that. So here you have what a set of factors or facts that somebody, whether a judge or a jury, has to consider and draw some legal conclusion about whether or not it's appropriate to convict a person of two separate offenses or only one offense. And so just because Hoyt says that it's a matter of law, it doesn't render it immune from a jury consideration. You can still submit a legal question like that to the jury, giving them the factors to consider and let them decide that, even if Hoyt is good law. So I'm still arguing that that's the case.
Assuming for the sake of argument that you were entitled to an instruction in the separation between the inherent restraint and the restraint that would be necessary for an abduction, that this was theory of your case, you had more than a scintilla of the evidence, etc. Why isn't it, after all is said and done, why isn't it harmless error in any event, given that the door was locked during this, and locking the bathroom door would not be an element of rape. There's no question, that was an undisputed fact that the door was locked, and so isn't that enough anyway to support abduction, and so it would be harmless error in this case?
I don't believe it's harmless error because we don't know how the jury would have assessed the full set of facts. I mean, you've cited one fact, locking the door. It could easily be argued that that's no more than necessary to effect a rape in a party where there's, you know, perhaps hundreds of people. So, you know,
but
some privacy.
But is an innocent explanation necessarily reject? It is an innocent explanation that it was done to ensure privacy is no longer available to you because of the jury's ultimate verdict on the rape, correct?
I'm sorry, what was the question?
That the locking of the door had an innocent explanation is no longer available to you given the jury's conclusion on the rape.
I don't believe that. I still think the issue is one of abduction here and detention and whether or not how a jury would have assessed the full set of facts, not just one fact. And I think it's the full set of facts that the jury needs to consider in order to do that. And they're entitled to do that, even if Hoyt is upheld and said it's a matter of law.
Comparing this case to Smith, there is more accepting the victim's testimony, which I think we have to at this point given the standard review. There's more physical force, there's a longer distance, and there's the locking of the door. So on straight sufficiency as to whether the evidence was sufficient to allow for both abduction with intent to defile and the rape, you lose the sufficiency test.
I don't believe...
A fact finder could conclude from the evidence that they were separate.
I don't believe so, mainly because I think it's a jury issue, but assuming that this court takes these facts as historical facts. Now, mind you, the court never ruled on this because the court just said it's a jury instruction. That's part of the administration of this Hoyt doctrine, that the court didn't even know what the law really required. So the court didn't rule on it. And so in terms of comparing facts and things, I would argue that this case is far closer to Hoyt than it is to, say, Brown. Now, Brown was the first case where this thing came up, and it was a double jeopardy challenge to it.
I specifically asked about Smith because Smith involves an allegation of abduction with intent to defile and a subsequent attempted rape. Involves a motion to strike at both the close of the Commonwealth's evidence and at the close of all the evidence. And, I mean, it seems to me to fit this, and what this court did in a published decision in Smith is rely on what the reasonable conclusions and inferences to be drawn from the jury's guilty verdict and filled in all of the details as the historical facts. That seems to be exactly what you're asking us not to do.
I'm asking you not to do that because it puts you in the position of being a fact finder.
Do you agree that that's what this court did in Smith?
It probably is. I think that's okay. An inappropriate, and I think Justice Kelsey would have said the same thing. That's an inappropriate role for this court to play.
But we did it in a published opinion that's binding on this court. So once again, you may want to check another box on something you want to argue later.
Thank
and
you.
And consider it checked.
Thank you, Your Honor. And so the question is, if it is a jury issue, even if it's a matter of law, then it's appropriate to give a jury instruction, And Harry's, you know, the Terry case from 1987 is proper to instruct a jury of the types of evidence a jury could use to reach a legal conclusion. And that case happened to be a case of possession with the intent to distribute, and they wanted to put an instruction in to say these are the factors to consider in determining whether he had the intent. So it's a legal conclusion, and the factors. So I'm arguing that this case is parallels a lot of other cases and factors to consider to draw a legal conclusion to determine whether or not a verdict is guilty or not guilty is an appropriate way to handle this case in court.
To go your way on this would require us to somehow go get around the Lawler decision 2013 from the Virginia Supreme Court, and in that particular case the court ruled that there was not error in failing to instruct the jury on detention, whether it was an inherent part of the capital murder charge. It said it was a question of law to be determined by the court, and accordingly, the court did not err in denying the instruction. How do we get around that?
Your Honor, I'm still getting to the. I don't know whether in that case they specifically put before the court that was a jury issue as opposed to a.
They asked for an instruction.
They asked for an instruction. I'm arguing that court got it wrong too, and so you know, and I think it all needs to be revisited. But let's assume
not only can a panel of three not help you, 11 of us can't help you.
Let's assume that that's not wrong. And that everything is a legal issue, purely a legal issue, and then the underlying legal challenge to this whole doctrine was a double jeopardy case. So the question is this subject to a pretrial hearing under 19.2266.2? I would argue that probably is appropriate. If this thing really is a double jeopardy issue, it's a constitutional issue that you can't convict of two. under certain facts, then you ought to have a pretrial hearing to determine facts. Then this court can plausibly rule and say the court got it right. But in the middle of a trial, I think it's a little
turning back to Lawler, which didn't embrace the four factors from Hoyt, it acknowledged them and then basically ignored them. It says that so long as the abduction crime involves an element that wasn't present, very much like the double jeopardy analysis you're talking about, forcing somebody down the hall 40 feet and locking the bathroom door are not an element of rape, correct?
No, locking the door would not be an element of rape, but it might be part of the overall restraint on the victim that the jury or the judge could consider as determining whether or not that was more than was necessary. Okay. Like I say, the judge ruled one way, and then his law of the case was that it was a jury issue and declined to give the jury instruction. So there's that sort of inconsistency within the case.
Except it seems to me it's completely consistent with Smith, where what he's ruling when he says, I'm denying the motion to strike, there's sufficient evidence, it's up to the jury to conclude what happened, but there's sufficient evidence. That's what a ruling on the motion to strike is.
And what I'm saying is the judge, you have to presume the judge knew the law and applied the law properly, and what I'm arguing is that the judge admitted that he didn't know the law. It's in the record. He says, I'm not familiar with this. He says, this is the first time it's come up. That was on...
Well, if by hook or by crook, or just by guessing, he falls into what Hoyt demands of him, then it's not error, is it? Whether he knew he was doing the right thing, he was acting consistent with Hoyt, as long as he did, he's okay.
The point is he didn't rule on the specific issue because he didn't understand the law. And that's what makes Hoyt so difficult as a matter of administration of justice here. Please, I'd like to move on. I've got 3 minutes here. Very quickly, the right to testify on your own behalf, it's a right that cannot be waived by counsel. The question is, does the court have a duty? The Fourth Circuit has said they have no duty. As long as it's on the record that the defendant knew of the right, I'd argue that that's insufficient.
Well, there's no Virginia case that...
There's no Virginia case. There's no U.S. Supreme Court case that says that. Fourth Circuit is the only one that comes on point that says it's sufficient if you can show that the defendant knew. I would argue that the waiver of fundamental right requires...
Isn't that in the record that the defendant knew? I mean, it's not in your brief, but I see on page 26 of the Commonwealth's brief that the right to testify was discussed with counsel.
It was discussed prior to a recess in the presence, but I'm arguing that knowing is not enough. The legal standard is knowing and voluntary. And he's got to... There's nothing in here that says he voluntarily...
Where was it argued at trial, not post-trial? Where was it raised at trial?
It wasn't. But I'm saying that there's a duty to establish.
Well, post trial, an argument is made. But every time I see it raised by your client post trial, the argument seems to be, I wanted to testify. My lawyer advised me not to. I followed the advice. How is that not a knowing and voluntary waiver? Because if he followed the advice, he wasn't coerced into not testifying. He chose to follow the advice.
Your Honor, that's a sort of a habeas issue, and that is a collateral attack. But what I'm arguing here is there's a duty of the court at the time to establish a knowing and voluntary waiver, and the court didn't do that.
Well, you do realize that by acknowledging it's a habeas issue, that's not one we touch.
No. I'm saying the duty of the court is one you can touch. The habeas issue, the ineffective assistance may not be.
What case gives us this duty as trial court judges to engage in a colloquy with the defendant about whether or not he wishes to testify?
There is no case that mandates it. I cited a case in my brief that did it as a model, but there's no case either on the Fourth Circuit or the U.S. Supreme Court,
so
or the Virginia Supreme
Court. Requesting a duty. It's not a duty that's there, right?
It's not an imposed duty at the present time. I'm arguing, though, that as a matter of law regarding his fundamental right, that it's a duty to acknowledge on the record a knowing and voluntary waiver. There's no issue
for
about
us to find no knowing and voluntary waiver. If it necessarily, it's your position that his trial counsel lied when the court asks. question.
Court didn't ask the question after the recess. There was no question asked after the recess. He asked the question in advance. He says, I haven't talked to him recently, but I will.
The way I looked at it, I think a fair way to interpret the exchange was, we're not going to, but I'll double check, and there's an implied, I'll get back to you if the answer has changed. Is that a fair reading of the record, do you think?
I think a fair reading of the record would be that he knew. The question is, was it voluntary? I don't think there's anything in the record indicating a voluntary waiver.
We've used up a great deal of your time. We'll give you a couple of minutes grace for rebuttal if you need it after hearing from the Commonwealth.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. The defendant in this case abducted and raped a young woman at a college party. The evidence showed that he forcefully removed her from the part of the apartment where people were dancing and forcibly put his hands on her waist and pushed her down a hallway approximately 40 feet, pushed her into a bathroom, and locked the door. Once inside, the victim begged the defendant to stop while he sexually assaulted her. The defendant has alleged multiple assignments of error in this case, but the record clearly demonstrates there's no merit to any of those assignments of error.
Well, on the jury, on the granting of the jury instruction, as I read through the ruling of the court, the only reason that I saw that the trial judge gave for not granting the proffered instruction was that it was not a model jury instruction. If that were the case, that would violate statute, wouldn't it? Isn't that error automatically?
I agree that is what the... not sure I can quickly find that part of the record.
He could be right for the wrong reason, though, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. Absolutely, Your Honor. I think that is what the trial court was kind of articulating why one of his problems for this, but the Commonwealth did argue that this was reciting case law that was completely inappropriate for the jury to try to interpret case law.
There was the use of the word confusion, I think, was used once by the Commonwealth, but I thought it was interesting that the trial judge, when he made his ruling on the instruction, did not say anything about confusion. He was focused completely on it's not a model jury instruction. I tend not to grant instructions that are not models.
Assuming Hoyt is correct, and at least for right now, that is the working assumption of this court, you wouldn't instruct the jury on a purely legal question, would you?
Correct, Your Honor.
How is a jury to apply the factors of Hoyt, then, if this is a jury issue, whether there was abduction, force applied, separate and apart from the force necessary to consummate the rape, then how is a jury to make the determination if on one hand it's a jury issue and on the other hand they're not told the factors that they're to apply based on Hoyt?
Well, Your Honor, I think we've kind of skipped a couple steps in our discussion today because it is a legal question and it is for the trial court to decide whether or not the Commonwealth has produced sufficient evidence to get past the legal question, and then therefore the Commonwealth, which is what happened in this case, and it appears that the defendant is now stepping away from his first assignment of error, and that says that the trial court got it wrong when it denied the motion to strike and said, okay, there's sufficient evidence here, and now this can go forward to the jury. I believe that's on page 340 and 341, is what actually happens in this motion to strike, is the defendant argues the evidence is insufficient for the abduction for all the conduct that is occurring prior to him entering the bathroom. He says that's not enough for the abduction, and then once you get into the bathroom, everything in there is contained within the sexual assault charges. And the Commonwealth responds and says, well, no, there's multiple points until you get up there that he has detained her beyond the sexual assault charges. He's completed an abduction before he ever gets into the bathroom.
And the trial judge said, and the trial court said, okay, it's a jury issue.
Exactly. So the trial court is adopting.
So how's a jury to make the determination then, given that the one applies four factors under Hoyt to separate out whether there's a standalone abduction conviction to be had or not.
The jury doesn't have to determine that. The jury is instructed on all the elements of the crime and is able to determine that there is a completely separate abduction in this case and a rape and a forcible sodomy.
And doesn't Lawler specifically say we don't give this instruction?
Correct, Your Honor. That is what Lawler says, what this case, this court also has, it's an unpublished opinion, but in Anderson, almost an identical jury instruction in that case, and this court in an unpublished opinion, but I think it is instructive, that said that was proper because it's not for the jury to try to interpret this legal standard that the case law has determined. It's up for the trial court to say, yes, Commonwealth, you get past this. Now go ahead, go forward with your facts, and the jury can determine whether or not the defendant abducted, raped, and sodomized this woman.
When the Lawler court ruled that the trial court did not hear in denying the instruction, wasn't that just a shorthand way of saying that there was not as much as a scintilla of evidence to support that theory of the defense, and therefore it was not an error to not give the instruction?
That is not my understanding when I read Lawler. I believe it's actually a very short discussion of it in the case, and it pretty much says this is a question of law, therefore the trial court did not abuse its discretion in granting it.
Was the proffered instruction in this case an accurate restatement of the factors that were set forth in Hoyt?
I think it is. I am fairly confident that it is an accurate statement of the factors in the case law, yes.
So it's not, there's not a question about whether this was a legally accurate instruction?
No, Your Honor. It was just a question of whether or not it was appropriate or whether it was just going to confuse the jury and really wasn't something that was in their province to decide.
And, you agreed, do you not, then, that there was more than a scintilla of evidence to support the defense theory that there was not a separate force applied that would support a charge of abduction?
I would not agree with that.
You would not?
I do not think that.
I mean, the defense was, it was all consensual. I didn't kidnap her. I didn't rape her. She went down the hall voluntarily. She went into the bathroom voluntarily. We locked the door voluntarily. We engaged in sexual activity voluntarily. So the scintilla of evidence that there was no rape and no abduction was this was all consensual. It was not that I committed a rape, but I didn't commit the others. That wasn't the evidence. That was the legal argument.
Correct, Your Honor. And based on this record, I do not believe that there is any evidence that the actions the defendant committed were all contained within a rape.
I'm sorry, I take it the Commonwealth's position would be that the abduction was completed upon the locking of the door.
Yes, Your Honor.
And actually was completed, could have been deemed completed several steps before that as they're walking down the hall.
Absolutely, Your Honors. This case is, I think, even more extreme than some Quorum and Smith and some of the other cases that I cited in my brief because you have a lot of action here prior to him ever attempting to commit the sexual assaults. It is clearly putting her in more danger, not inherent of those crimes, for him to push her 40 feet away from all other people and lock her behind a door. And I think that this is just, there's a lot of other argument going on here, but I think when you just look at what this case actually is, it simply does not fit within the intrinsic restraint doctrine, and the trial court was completely within its discretion when it denied that motion to strike, when it moved forward, when it denied that instruction because it was not proper.
Is there any instruction that would be proper in a case such as this to help the jury appreciate that in reaching their verdict on rape and abduction, they need to take into account that legally those need to be two separate events, two separate acts?
I do not believe that it would be appropriate to instruct the jury on that. I think what the trial court did, the trial court said, you can argue factually that he didn't actually complete the abduction, but the jury has the elements of the offense in front of them, and perhaps it's up to the defendant to raise the legal issue, and perhaps if this is totally, but if after he moved to set aside a verdict, he could try to move to set aside a verdict saying that the jury's verdict was inconsistent with the law. But it's not in this case. The jury's verdict in this case is completely supported by the facts, and the trial court was proper in all the actions it took related to these assignments of errors. As this court has already discussed today with the defendant, Lawler and Anderson say that this jury instruction is not proper. This court should follow the Lawler decision. Moving to the third assignment of error, this court should not take the defendant up on his invitation to create a new requirement for trial courts across the Commonwealth to engage in a colloquy with the defendant about his right to testify. It's clear based on this record that the defendant was made aware of his right to testify and did not, based on advice of counsel, know of evidence of coercion, which, as this court has also recognized, would actually not be a proper collateral attack in this court. And simply, Commonwealth would ask that.
Let me ask you about the fourth and fifth assignments of error.
Sure.
Because I want to give him an opportunity to rebuttal if he wants to. The fourth assignment of error, is there anything in the answers that the potential juror gave, other than she's a women's studies professor, that would even suggest or hint that she couldn't be fair and impartial?
No.
So this is based on the argument that's being made, it appears to be a per se rule that her occupation disqualifies her.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there any support anywhere in Virginia law for such a position?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. On the fifth assignment of error, assuming that the answer to the jury's question was incorrect, let's just assume that, was it waived when the defendant acquiesced in the answer?
Yes. Not only did he acquiesce, he completely agreed to the answer, but yes, Your Honor.
But even if we were to assume the answer to the question about concurrent sentences was incorrect, and even if we were to assume that there was an acquiescence in the answer, weren't all the sentences run concurrently?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, the two sexual assault charges were run with the abduction, yes. So, essentially, his argument about how he was deprived the right to a sentence by his jury is...
To the extent that the jury was allowed to make a recommendation, assuming they had made a recommendation favorable to him, he got what the jury recommended, would have hypothetically recommended.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And if there are no further questions, the Commonwealth would rest on its brief.
Thank you, Ms. Campbell. Mr. Weber, we will give you 2 minutes.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. I've got three very, very brief points.
Yes,
one
sir.
Is, and I had made a note of this, and has to do with that jury instruction, what the court ruled. Court ruled sort of as a matter of personal policy that it's not a model jury instruction, and that I think by definition is an abuse of discretion. He should exercise some discretion there as to whether
but
or not.
But can't
that
he
jury,
be right for the wrong reason?
It may be, but I'm still arguing that he's entitled to it in this case because the judge said it was a jury issue, and my client's entitled to that jury instruction. With regard to the refusal to strike for cause, he did not use the word public confidence in his argument. I would argue if you read the argument on page 118 of the joint appendix, it is a public confidence argument. It's not a specific she's biased because of this. It's sort of by association, her long experience dealing with victims of sexual...
Yeah, I mean, basically you're arguing for a rule that a women's studies professor cannot sit on a sexual assault jury.
I think given her experience and her depth of experience, particularly with the victims, I would argue that as a matter of public confidence, that would not be the prudent thing to do.
But
in this case.
Prudent and required are two different things, though.
And I point to the Patterson case, and the Patterson case was the same thing where public confidence, the words public confidence were not argued, but the argument was made, and the court undertook it and reversed it.
But for instance, police officers can serve on juries. They almost always get struck, but they can.
They can testify, you know.
Well, I mean, they can serve on juries.
Yeah, they can serve on juries. That's what I'm saying.
But if one's occupation would disqualify one from being fair, one might think that would be a disqualifying event. I mean, where would we draw the line?
It's not her occupation. It's her personal experience over 20 years dealing almost solely with the victim side of the criminal justice system. I think that that's what raises, it even raised the concerns of the court. The court even admitted, you know, I had some concerns about this. It was only because she was so, you know, forceful in convincing me that she could be unbiased that I'm going to overrule the motion.
But we owe that determination deference, do we not, since he saw it, listened to her?
The same deference that the juror got in Patterson, and I'm saying that the court has an independent duty to look at that. 27 seconds, the jury question. I think the jury is entitled to make recommendations, not just a recommendation on whether they ought to run concurrent. I mean, ultimately, the judge ran the two sentences concurrently. But juries ought to be treated with more respect than to just say, you don't have the power to do that. You know, they do have the power to make recommendations to the court. Supposing...
But what is the potential... Given the question was, can we recommend that they be run concurrently? Assuming you're right and the jury should have been allowed to... Should have been told, yes, you could make a recommendation. What is the potential harm that was suffered given that the sentences were, in fact, run concurrently?
Suppose they wanted to recommend that he only got 10 years.
Well, except they got to do that. They sentenced him.
They sentenced him to 25 and 5. So, I mean...
But their question wasn't, can we sentence him to 10 years? It was, will the sentences be run concurrently? They gave him the sentences that they wanted to give him, 25 and 5. Maybe
they gave him less because they couldn't recommend concurrent sentences.
The judge ultimately ran the sentences concurrent,
jury, when told by the judge that they can't recommend that they run them concurrent, maybe the jury came back and gave him less time because of that.
I argue that these types of answers to a jury don't give the proper respect to the jury in a case like this, where the jury does have the power to make recommendations to the court that's independent of what they're required to do by law. And I think the juries ought to be given that respect. And that's where I even have a problem with the model jury instruction in this case. I just think that juries do have that power. And it's in our Constitution where it says, in accordance with the law or the judgment of his peers. So that judgment of his peers in the Constitution of Virginia puts a lot of power in the hands of the jury. And I think we ought to treat them with that level of respect. Thank you, Your Honor.
Very well, thank you. We'll come down and greet counsel and then take up the case of Williams versus the Commonwealth.